That, you know, so the American one always was more yelling and screaming and emotional and this and that and throwing things around, and while the British was very, very calm and, you know, stuff like that, you know, so it's, does that make sense? You know, it's like the American one, then, you know, a secret agent, he's been caught that he's being a double agent, right? And so then, you know, the boss and his other what do you call it, associates, they're all yelling and screaming, how could you know this and that, so many things, it's just so emotional, and you know it gets rough and all that. Then they switch over to the British, and then, you know, they're all sitting there very quietly and formally, and then the head guy says, you know Smith, we've come across this information and all that, and, you know, slides it across the table, so, you know, the picture. And so, you know, we're very disappointed in all this, so, you know what has to happen. And he says, yes, and he said, and then Smith says, what about the family? And then the boss says, don't worry, they're taken care of. And then that's it. So it's like a 15-second thing, while in the American thing, it goes over minutes, and you understand like that. So sometimes, depending upon the scenario, may have some flavors of this, that, but generally we would tend towards a little bit more reserved. Like that, though it's not as popular, because, as you say, you know, the whole world watches Hollywood, not necessarily British stuff. But you want to be very. Point is, this culture is there because they're Krishna's living entities, and being conditioned means you make mistakes. So if someone makes a mistake, we shouldn't be surprised. Right, that's always the thing, because there's a taste in being shocked and being surprised and how that can happen. And it's like, what is anybody surprised about? You know what I'm saying? That's the whole thing, is that Prabhupada said, don't be surprised who goes away, be surprised who stays. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole thing. We're so shocked, this one did this, that one did that, but the point is it's a material world. That's what people do here. So if someone gives that up and actually does something in Krishna consciousness and sticks to that, that should be the surprising thing. Wow, that's nice. That's good. Not that, oh, how can that happen? Oh, they're a leader. How can that happen? It's just like, it's just strong. The reality is that you're in the material world. That these things happen. It's not good. It shouldn't happen. There's no benefit to it happening. You know, it's not that it's all right, because there'll be reactions for it. It's just the way it goes. But you know, there's obstacles in everything you do. So why won't there be obstacles in the development of Krishna consciousness, right? So therefore, considering that, you deal what's appropriate to try to get the person to either adjust and take up a better position of Krishna consciousness, or to at least neutralize their position so that they can't disturb others' position of Krishna consciousness. Because right? The point is you're trying to cultivate Krishna consciousness. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
Could you a little elaborate the what is actually, what should be the main emphasis for the rulers in order to bring Krishna consciousness to the state, you know, the state how it is now? So what should be like the main emphasis? I think Prabhupada is giving some list of things which in general should be done, but still, you know, I mean, of course we have one sense discussed this from different angles, but still, you know, is it like, you know, how would I say, on the consciousness level, kind of awareness that Krishna consciousness, spirituality will bring ultimate happiness? You know, like,
that's the main thing is that, as you see, is that Pritu Maharaj himself is a Krishna conscious person.
Yeah.
His own determination, and that whether he's the king or not, he will practice Krishna consciousness. That's the, you could say, is the first point. Then being on that level, then according to your position, then you apply Krishna consciousness. So therefore for a ruler, then they have to see that Krishna consciousness is there for the benefit of the citizens. Right? So it's not that it's only the spiritual, it also has to be the material facilities are taken care of. So you see, like we were discussing yesterday, sometimes you get fanatic religionists, and it's only about the God-conscious side that they're worried about, and the ritual is connected. Material facility, they don't think is important. They'll say it's all you know, how you say, bad. But the point is that people are in this world because of these facilities, right? And so, therefore, those should be taken care of. But it can't be that that's the prominence. It always has to be God consciousness is your prominence. And then the material facility is in support of that. Right? So that being in support of that, then the two go together. Because from Dharma comes Artha. So they want facility, so they have to do Dharma. What's their inspiration to do Dharma? So that it doesn't degrade them is the spirituality of the God consciousness. So if people do the proper work with the spiritual understanding, that will keep it from degrading when they get Artha. Otherwise, they perform the Dharma, they get Artha, and then they drop on that. Right? You know, it's just like the American thing, on all the money it says, in God we trust. Right? But then, nowadays, you don't necessarily see that that's a prominent element. It was sometime back, like maybe 20 or 30 years back, it was even discussed, you know, on the governmental level, on whether we should, that should stay on the money or not. And I'm not sure, I mean, it's still there, so whether it was, they decided in support of it, or just because it's a traditional thing, like, you know, Coca-Cola, it shouldn't change, so therefore they left it on there. I'm not sure if it was a, you know, more of a spiritual understanding, or if it was just a, you know, it's all American or something, you know, like 4th of July. Does that make sense? So the point is that it starts in one way, but when people get Artha, then they tend to forget about Dharma. So how to maintain that you don't drop as you have facility. So the only way you can actually have good material facility is if you're God conscious. So sometimes you're thinking, oh, but they're God conscious, why do they need this facility? Technically, in one sense, they don't. But the same time as if you perform activities to please Krishna, the activities you're going to perform will be religious or dharmic. And because of dharma, then you get economic development, you get artha. So therefore, you're in the performance of devotional service, you will naturally get facilities. That's just the way it works. But because you're only interested in God consciousness, therefore whatever facilities you use doesn't distract you from God consciousness, but it's just something more to engage in the Lord's service. Right? So the only way you can actually have a consistently prosperous state is if the people are spiritual. Otherwise, it won't stay consistent like that, because at some point they'll degrade. Because as they have facility, just like you see, father runs into difficulty when he's young, you know, and that he has to take up responsibility, let's say the family, or something like when he's 12 years old, or this, he works hard, he builds an empire, he's super, you know, he's a billionaire. Then he has his son doesn't have to work at all, everybody does everything for him, like that. Now the tendency, whether that son will have that same focus and determination as the father, or whether he'll be a bit of a playboy and waste his time and money and everything like that, you know. So instead of being able to take dynamic part in and working things in the company from the time he's 16, 18 years old, it's not until he gets into his 30s that he finally calms down enough that, you know, he can actually do something. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem, it degrades. And then what about the grandchildren? You know, what's going to be their position? And so you just see as it goes down, things get smaller and smaller. You know, you take these big, big families that 400 years ago, they owned everything. As time goes, they own less and less. Why? Because they don't know how did they own everything? Because they made it. You know what I'm saying? They worked, they got the money, they bought things, they built things, they, you know, like this. They organized things. But as time goes, is basically they can kind of maintain, and they do pretty good, and they have more than anybody else. But they can't do what the previous ones did, so they're having to sell everything. Right? You know, so many museums, so many big public things, they all belong to somebody who was really rich before. You know, and either there's no one qualified to take over, or, yeah, so then it's lost. Does that make sense? So that's the thing, as it goes down, they become weaker and weaker. You know, have that austerity, that determination. So the Vedic culture ensures that you maintain the austerity, you know, the sense control, the intelligence, the determination, all these things required to materially advance. And the determination to do that, if it's only material, it still will degrade at some point, right? So, you know, you don't think about making a country that will, you know, will be fabulous and the top of the world for the next 25 years. They think, you know, it's here for eternity, you know, forever, you know, what do you call it? Edelweiss will grow forever, right? You know, that's how it's thought, right? You know, it's not, you know, that's just, you know, it's God's given their blessings, of course it's going to be there forever. Like that, you know, like that. America is, what, 200 years old, and they're talking forever. They've always been talking forever. It's 200 years old. Practically, you know, in Europe, every country's been around longer than that. You know, I'm saying Greek, you know, for the last, you know, whatever it is, 4,500 years or something, you know, like that. And, you know, Rome's been there for over 2,000 years.
Even Russia is young. Russia is young. It was just three different, you know, areas.
Yeah. But still, there was some kingdom there. There were the Moscow kings.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't have everything, you know, like that. Maybe Vladivostok belonged to the
Novgorod, Moscow, and Belarus.
Yeah, but I'm saying those were there, and then they expanded it. But America, the empires belonged to the Cherokee and the Iroquois and the, you know, these ones. And then, how you say, the Europeans came along and went, wow, what a nice place, you know. And then, so basically speaking then, if whatever it is, they think it'll be forever. And they're saying like that, you know, the Russian Empire, but how long has it been a big empire? Like you said, it's not that long, you know.
Less than Sweden and Finland.
Yeah, so they've been around more, right? So, you know, and, you know, some say even the Vikings went over and had a settlement in America, you know, so, like that.
Still, you know, the spirituality, religion, and Krishna consciousness are used, but they are not all synonyms. Could you a little define? I mean,
in so you say spirituality?
Spirituality, Krishna consciousness, and religion.
Yes, no, they're not all. They all go together, but they're not synonymous. They're talking about different parts of a bigger process. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at the full process, they're all parts of the process. So, in other words, religion means pious activities. Spirituality means seeing things off the mundane plane on the platform of the soul. Right, and the supreme position of God, right? Then Krishna conscious means that we're actually conscious of God and how he does things, how things work. In other words, the universal laws and all that are coming from him. And so that further step of that is bhakti means that consciousness is favorable. So if we're talking Krishna consciousness, meaning devotional service, so then it would mean we're performing the religious activities from the spiritual position of not being attached to the results for the pleasure of Krishna. Yeah. Does that make sense? That makes it complete. Does that make sense? But so if the leadership is on that platform, then it makes it very easy to make everything else work. Because then, even if the citizens don't come up to fully that platform, at least they can appreciate the spiritual level, so the religious and the spiritual level. Right? So they can appreciate that there is universal laws, therefore there is universal right concepts of right and wrong. Therefore, if you follow what's right, you'll get a better result than if you do what's wrong. And so that way they'll be prosperous. So only if they maintain that. In other words, it's a theistic approach to religion. They have to accept that. Now whether they can go beyond to the point where that theism goes to actual true theism, where they understand the nature of the personality of Godhead and have that relationship and devotion towards, then you'll say that will be the most stable and most beneficial. But minimum, you have to have a theistic understanding that there's God, there's God's laws, and if we follow those laws, then things will work out nicely. Because if we take the atheistic, means we don't worry about God. We say how material energy works, though material energy doesn't seem to care, you know. And so then, you know, all these things come up, right? So it's the most unstable, right? But it's non-theistic. And now of non-theistic, where there's non-cooperation, everybody just does their own thing and this and that, and it's divided. The smaller the little groups it's divided into, the more less prosperous and maintainable it is. So if they work as a grand scale, then they can create more, but it still is unstable because it's not following the natural laws of the universe. Does that make sense?
Definitely. Could you give a little, you spoke actually that with the strategy that I had some phone call, which really what I could listen made sense, you know, that how the spirituality is ultimately benefiting all the different levels, but you know, a little missed that, and I think the others definitely also. So how to convince that spirituality, at least some aspect, how to convince how the spirituality is ultimately the most benefiting for all the other activities. You mentioned this, following the rules will be easier. That's as
well. Yes. Means you have the aspect, even if you just take it, even if people are not theistic, but just the concept that there's a supreme, right, that there is a God, then makes people more prone towards doing what's right. Now, whether that right, what's right, is according to the universal laws, or whether they're not, but at least they will follow the social system. Right? Let's say the government is atheistic, they come up with their own laws and concepts of, you know, social standards. If there's a concept that there's a supreme and that he's seeing this and he's judging this, then people have a tendency to follow the laws better than if not. And then you also have the aspect is that, as we said, if you want to look at things scientifically, then there's a 50% chance that there is God. Right? You could say he either exists or doesn't, so it's 50-50. Yeah. So now if he does exist and you follow the rules, then you'll get the benefit of his existing. If he exists and you didn't follow the rules, then you're in trouble. Right? Now, if he doesn't exist and you follow the rules, you get the benefit from following the rules, so there's no loss.
Yeah.
Right? If there's no further afterlife and this and that, it doesn't matter because you got the benefit from following the laws now. Right? And if there isn't a God and you don't follow the rules, then you don't get the benefit, you know, from the present position. So therefore, you can see what gets the most maximum is if you believed in God. Therefore, you'll get the benefits now, and if there are benefits later, you'll get that also. Right? Does that make sense? And even if there isn't a God, then at least you'll get the benefits from now. But if you don't follow the rules, you don't get any benefits now. And if there is a later, then you lose out there also. So just socially it works better if there's a concept of God. Even if it's incomplete or this or that, there's something, you know, it's saying speculative. There'll be some tendency to follow the rules. So even on the atheistic position, it still works better. And so that means there's some value in being God conscious. Right? Does that make sense? Now, what was being suggested here is that we can make up our own rules, but if it's against the laws of nature, it won't work anyway. So why even take that position? In other words, one should follow the laws of nature because that's how things work. Right? That's the science. In other words, it's very strange that a society that bases itself on science doesn't follow the laws of nature, you know. Does that make sense? You would think that if science is valued, then we'd follow the laws of nature. Right? So therefore, that's what's said, the theistic approach is, why the laws of nature are there, why they're consistent. Because there has to be one supreme who is making that all work. Otherwise, there wouldn't be consistency. If there were many supremes, right, many gods, then they would all run things differently. Right? Each one would run differently. So wherever the demarcation between the two realms worked, then when you're on this side, it would work one way. When you walk to the other side, it would be completely different. You know, like this side, it looks like a Rembrandt. When you walk over that line, and everything turns into Picasso or something. You know, so it would be strange. The laws would be different, but the laws are the same everywhere, and they see they're the same in the whole universe. So that consistency means there has to be one supreme controlling it. Right? So therefore, since that's the position, that you follow these laws, it doesn't matter where you follow them, they work on all levels. Therefore, then following these laws, because there's that, they're coming from the Supreme, that's then the minimum standard you want to do. Because by following, I'll get a good benefit. So that's the level of karma. But when we add in the spiritual, then we understand we're the soul, we're not the body. Therefore, there is a temporariness to the material situation we can generate from our pious activities. So then if the soul is eternal but the body's not, then we would want to make sure that in taking care of the body that the soul is living in, we don't in any way jeopardize the development of the soul proper. Right? You can't sacrifice a higher thing for a lower thing. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the principle that's there. So then by seeing the spiritual, then there's the element that the ability to control the senses, to follow the laws in a more of a detached way, so that the quality of work will be better, is easier. And since the quality of work is better, the material facilities will be better also. But your ability to deal with better facilities is easier because of the control of the senses, because of the higher knowledge. So that way is why we said before, is you could have more material facility and at the same time not misuse it. So the higher the consciousness, the more facility you can have and not misuse it. Does that make sense? So it's just like, let's say we have, you know, your standard also thing of the, how do you call it? We have the old rich and the new rich. You have that, right? So the old rich, what's the difference between the two? Because technically they may have the same amount of money. The main thing is the culture. So you talk to the new rich, you know, he's showing the rich, he's talking, and you know, it can be a little loud. But those who are from old rich, then they'll be cultured, how they'll deal, how they'll talk, how they'll dress. It'll always be appropriate. Right? So they can live in a rich environment as standard. Well, the new rich, then they come in, they gotta spend their money, they gotta do all kinds of stuff, they gotta show it off, they gotta get what they can out of it.
Yeah, these old rich, they don't make any point of them. You know,
no,
it's there definitely. But
it's just the situation in which they exist is richness. They don't exist in poorness. So therefore, it's being rich is not something to jump up and down about. It's just what you do. Well, for the new rich, then you know I made it. This that they got to make a show out of it. Go out buy all kinds of crazy stuff. This and that. They don't. Like one person. You know, somehow in the conversation it came up that someone asked him, how much money do you have? And he basically says, I don't know. But he said, I could give you examples. I could go out and go totally crazy, buy whatever I could dream of buying. You know, that includes, you know, airplanes, islands, you know, whatever it is that you could get your hands on. and he still would have money. Because, you know, when you're dealing in that level, then your investments and this and that, where it's moving and this, you don't exactly know. You could go in and look and calculate, but at the moment you don't know. But he was this really gentle, unassuming, quiet person. Like that, you know, that just, you know, dealt nicely. And remember once he was talking about the ceiling in this one, the room where he was staying, it was double. It wasn't this height, it was double that. It had that. And he was talking about, you know, this is quite nice. You know, it's because it's a higher ceiling, so it's more aristocratic. The higher the ceiling, the more it's considered like that. And I said, well, in our grass hut, it's even double that. He said, really?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that was all that there was. And then a few days later, when I came back to the Gurukul, he was there sitting in our hut. And he says, oh, you've come? He says, yes, I've come to see the highest ceiling in Mayapur. And he was just chanting his japa and looking up. And, yeah, this is... you know, but it was very unassuming. So that's the thing. They're from these old rich families. You know, so, you know, they'll do what's necessary. They won't do something not necessary. Yeah. You know, like if it's impractical to take the car because of something, they'll take a taxi. Well, the new barista's got to take his fancy car. He can't not walk. You know, I got money. Why would I take a taxi? Yeah. But they'll do whatever needs to. Or if they need to walk, they'll do that. Yeah. You know, it's just that so the culture is the whole thing. So that's what we're saying, is this culture is then, the higher the consciousness, the better it is to deal with prosperity. So if the government's looking at, so as we see, is God consciousness and prosperity go together as how the government's supposed to establish. So that means you can't establish, in general, higher prosperity unless you improve the consciousness. So without spirituality, you can't actually have a very consistently prosperous country, right? Because the consciousness won't be high enough. Because otherwise, then people get money and they want to take everybody else's money, and it won't work. It's like what do you call it? I told the story of the Mauritian frogs. No Mauritian frogs. We all know Mauritius. No. We all know frogs. And so we have a place to start from. So. One day we were discussing something with a Mauritian devotee about the tendency of the devotees to, you know, be critical. And then he told the story of the Mauritian frog. So, because it's an island, so I guess there's tons of frogs and everything like that. You know, must be. Otherwise, why use frogs? They would use something else. But so he told this joke. So he said that one day some big company in France put out a tender for frogs, because French like frogs, right? So then different places in the world that had frogs, and they put in their bids, right? You know, so Mauritius, you know, Bangladesh, some other places, they all put in their bids. And then, having got the bids, then they called all these people. And then at one point they called the Mauritian, you know, who was representing the Mauritian frog, whatever it is, company, you know, they say, Public Unlimited or whatever it is. You know. And so then they called them in and says, okay, we've talked to everybody else. Everybody else's prices are competitive. You know, like a little bit above, a little below, you know, you talk to them this, they can make adjustments and all this. But he says the prices that you've given on the Mauritian frogs is so much lower than everybody else. It's way below. So we have a doubt. Are you just, how can you do that? No one else can do that. You know, so are you just saying that just to get our attention, but actually you can't produce, you can't provide like that? He says, no, that's an actual price we can provide. He says, well, how is that? Because you know, it's frogs in boxes and this and that. How is this going to be like that? He says, we save money on the lids, right? Everybody else has to have the box, and then they have to have the lid, right? You know, the lid has a thing, it has to double back, it's a little bit more difficult to make. So we don't spend any money on lids. That's where we save. He says, no lids, but then the frogs will jump out of the box. He says, no, these are Mauritian frogs. He says, what has that got to do with it? He says, they're so envious of each other. If one frog tries to jump out, the others will grab him and pull him back in. So he's making the point is because there's so much envy, no one can progress. If anyone does a little better, everyone will attack and bring them down. He was giving the example, that's how like slums work. Someone could go out and get a job in that, but everybody else would just bring them down. So no one can get out of the slum. Like that. So that's the thing. Without character, no one can progress. So that's the thing. As the populace is situated more, at least, how you say, approves of the mode of goodness ideals, then the better it will work. They may be impassioned ignorance, but at least they consider that a higher position. That you can behave right, you can be, that's good. I wish I could do that, but they have that. But if you take the things, oh, we don't care for that, you know, then the good society can't develop. So you have to establish these higher character, and that can only be done by higher consciousness. So then the easiest way is through spirituality, because the other is then it can take generations of proper association, and you can't do that. You have to take the people you have now. That can only be done with spirituality. Right? Now, of spirituality, to maintain that, then you have to have that God consciousness. Right? It means you're conscious of the Supreme is there, the universal laws that are there, governed by the Supreme. It works by that method, that potency. Then at least you'll be able to be somewhat progressive. But if you add in further that the Supreme is a person, and therefore then what's the reason behind these laws, things make much more sense. And then if you take it to the step further that the soul has a natural relationship with this person, then that will maintain the highest standard. Does that make sense? But until you get to that transcendental level, you can't actually maintain the material at a progressive way. That's why in the Vedic system is dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So without the moksha aspect, you can't, dharma, artha, kama, can't maintain an elevated position.
It really makes sense. Like you said, also in the University of Oulu, I mean, they may deal with the pranamaya level, whatever, but the professor who has been there 20 years, she said, you know, that there is no real progress or development of any of these, you know, without character development.
Yes.
And she has seen that. Yes. 20 years professor, plus 20 years even before that as, mm-hmm. as a professional. Mm-hmm. So that's what the high professionals are saying anyhow.
Yes.
They come to the point.
Anybody who's actually, in reality, functioning in a successful way in the material world consistently, not just how you say, one day, one night wonder, or something like that is a name for that, you know? What?
One hit wonder
is that they do something fabulous as that and then they can't do anything more. But who's consistent,
they
actually will understand more what we're talking about than someone who's not.
Yeah.
Because they understand is that you don't follow certain things, you're not successful. It's not a matter of what you feel like. It's a matter of the reality. Now, you can have the qualities that we're saying that of determination, focus, sense control, you know, how you say, following the, you know, etiquette, dealing properly, all these things, then you'll be successful. It's not that, you know, you just feel like it, you get in your garage and, you know, it all happens like that. Does that make sense? Yeah, because otherwise, how much stuff comes out of a garage? Okay, Google came out of a garage, and I think Apple came out of a garage. And,
Microsoft.
Hmm?
Also Microsoft. Yeah.
Microsoft came out of a garage. Yeah. And I think they were garage friends, Microsoft and Apple, right? You know, until some point where I think Microsoft took a few of Apple's stuff and then they became less friends. But whatever it is, so that's three.
They also stole Nokia's phones, but they went down.
Okay, yeah, and then I think there's one or two bands that came out of a garage. like that, or a basement or something, you know. But not so much, you know. So it's not just that, just the, there has to, you have to follow the rules, and to maintain it, they're following rules.
Could we say still, hopefully the others try, you know, following the God's laws,
right,
affects also, like you said, you know, to the relationship, because and the social life, because to say that there are frank, how would I say, plain facts about the social life nowadays, it's maybe not on zero, it's on minus, although there is some, again, strong marketing that the you know, social media and everything, but it's just a fake, you know. People, technical interfaces has a lot maybe to do that they don't trust also the friends, because so, you know, anything can happen if they bring the wife to the some other, I mean, may not come back or something.
Yeah. No. The point is without character, then how can there be trust?
Yeah.
So the point is anamoy means it's about yourself. So the problem is that the pranamoy position of economics is at this point progressing due to, you know, its advertisement and that of people actually functioning on anamoya, right? You know, it's about, you know, you want this, you know, I think it was in India, credit card, because they don't generally use credit cards. This is a new thing about the credit cards. Why do you have to wait to buy what you want, right? Because otherwise, if you're using cash, you have to wait till you actually have the cash, then only you can buy. So why restrict yourself? With a credit card, you can buy it now, right? But that's not intelligent, right? And it's just about yourself, or you see these advertising campaigns where it's, you know, it's so good it's sinful, or, you know, it's so good you won't want to share it.
Yeah.
You know, so you have, you know, this family of the husband, the mother, and the kid, and the father's got this bowl of something, and he's trying to, you know, hide it and eat it, and the kids and the wife are, you know, attacking him, trying to take it away from him. You know, so it brings this whole anamoy platform. And so because of that, because it's lower consciousness, is easier to cultivate. Right? And so then because of that, then people are buying. But then what's not understood is because they're dropping to the mode of anamoya, right? That perspective, then they won't actually take part as well in the pranamaya culture that actually makes things go. So they make the money, but it'll be harder to maintain it because there's so many people trying to take it away and not following the rules. And, you know what I'm saying? So it's you know, it's like trying to, you know, boil something but at the same time pouring cold water into it or something. It's just, it's not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You so that's why in the Vedic system you have to see is no dharma is your basic platform. Artha kama will come anyway. If dharma is there, artha comes. If you have artha, then you can have sense gratification. But without dharma, you're not going to get the other two. How do you maintain dharma? By having the spiritual understanding. Otherwise, as soon as you get something, then why you won't? You know, the dog's sitting there peacefully, throw something out to eat, and then they all jump on each other. Right? Does that make sense? So, I mean, okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, because otherwise you have to have very trained. Let's say you have these dogs, you know, I think I've seen once, you have these really, you know, a breed of dog that's known for its viciousness and that, and then they put out something to eat or put a cat there or that, and they all sit there. They won't move. But if at any point then whoever's in control of the dogs then says that they can, you know, give up that position, then you see, you know, then that cat is, you know, how you say, takes on a more of a historical position, right, rather than a contemporary. Yeah. So that's the whole thing, is that control of the senses, then things can be done. As soon as the senses aren't controlled, then it's every man for themselves. You know, then it's that dog-eat-dog position. So that's why the government has to be able to see these higher principles. So economics, yes, you have to have economics, but not at the expense of the whole society. Because the way it's going now, if the business community has its say and runs it how it runs, the whole thing will be destroyed. They don't, it's not understood, they don't have enough vision to see that. Right? Maybe a few individuals know how to just keep it on the line, but still that's dangerous. What if it just goes over? Then what do? You know, that becomes very, very difficult. So the Vedic system is, no, you run it on this higher principle. It may appear that it's going to be slower, you don't immediately make as much, but over the long run, it's consistent and it's maintainable. So it's always better that you have something that is consistent than felt it was, you know, what's the importance of this? We're a secular state. They got rid of it. Then they saw that the character of the students went down so much that they can't even study, you know, let alone they come to the school, not kill each other, how they dress, how they behave. And so then it was seen that, and then they studied and they saw schools that had religious education, in other words, the private schools, they were able to maintain. So now they reintroduce religious studies in schools is the thing. Now, which one you want to do in this, that, you know, before it would have been just Christian or, you know, whatever the school was, but generally like that. But now it's like, okay, whichever one, but they have so much, you know, a certain amount of religious education. Because then they see is that the students maintain a better consciousness, therefore they can study. So, same as on the economic platform, same as on the, you know, the family, the social, all these different things, that the higher the consciousness, the better these things run. The lower the consciousness, then, you know, like that. You can't say what it'll be. Yes?
Is there a rise of, awareness of this also in the business world, that ethics or dharma is more important for them?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard. Have you heard anything? Or any studies, or they've seen this?
No. In America, there is some karma business, meaning like, you know, doing good, then results will be good. That's okay. Some Indian professors.
Okay. So maybe, but it'll be a new thing.
Yeah.
It won't be a standard thing. It means you have the ones that, okay, will be green or, you know, ecologically, you know, like this and that. But that's also because it's business. If no one cared about ecology, the businesses wouldn't either. You know what I'm saying? It's because people want organic, therefore then, because organic, see, if things aren't organic and people want organic, now if I provide organic, what's going to be the price comparison? I can charge more, right? When organic first came out, it was cheaper, you know, like that. But then, so it just works on that. You know, it's just, how you say, supply and demand. As we said, that's how the Western market, Indian market's different. The more of something it is, it must be better. So therefore, everyone wants it. And if there's not so much of it, then it can't be good, no one wants it. On the West, it's the other way around, you know, so. Indian economics is another realm. It doesn't work the same. Yes.
I heard some devotees say that one of the most successful companies in the Wall Street, they have a rule that you cannot gossip. You are not allowed to talk about the other, you know, and and if you do, you lose your job.
Well, it's just bad for business. And one, they're wasting time, wasting focus. It brings emotion into the whole process, and you can start rumors that can, you know, you can crash the market and stuff like that. So you just don't, you know, it's just not allowed. So they're careful about these things. They've seen what works. In other words, they would have been very studious of what happened since 29 when the market crashed. And so then they're going to be careful that doesn't happen again. Like that. But the point is that in any case, why would it work? It's because it's in line with Krishna's laws. So those who are smart are following some aspect of the laws enough that they have the facility that they have, like that. But the point is if they would combine all that, then you get a more complete system, then you get what the Vedas have to offer. Because all the things that are there, like, you know, it's just like, say, not sure anywhere else, but like in American, in the language, then there's two schools of thought. One is phonetic, one is linguistic. And so they fight over, you know, at one point one's prominent, one point's the other prominent, and this and that. But in the Vedic system is that you would use both of them. Why, if each has something good about it and some weakness, because the point is whatever's strong in phonetics, that will be weak in linguistics. Otherwise, how does phonetics have a position? Whatever's strong in linguistics will be weak in phonetics. Otherwise, how can linguistics stand up and say, yes, you know, these areas it's good and phonetics is not. So that means the Vedic is what's good of both is connected together in one thing. And what's bad of both is dropped. But this inability to balance things, that seems to be the Western disease or the non-Vedic disease, is they can't balance. And so it has to be one extreme or the other. They can't see that they go there. And so therefore following laws and everything is where the good part is. But since there has to be balance of good and bad, where's the bad? The bad is that you're dealing in the material world and it's not satisfying to the soul. Right? So that's the bad. So even though you have all facilities, it can't satisfy you. Right? We work on, we're not satisfied because we can't get, or we get and we lose. You know? Or we get and then we have all the problems from it. But the Vedic is no. You act piously, you can get the material facilities, but the point is it won't satisfy the soul anyway. But at least it's the comfortable environment in which to exist, and it is the nicest environment to take things and engage them in connection with the Supreme for spiritual upliftment. Right. So, therefore, then, that's the position. So the upside is proper activity and proper consciousness. The downside is this is the wrong place to be. Does that make sense? It's always going to have the temporary effect. Is that? Something else?
I have two questions. One, in this connection with this subject matter, in the business, they teach that that the company should have vision and mission and vision. But after 25 years in successful business and listening to your lectures, I have come to conclusion that this Western way of business, having its goal, profit can't have proper mission, because that mission is just a nice word, because the real mission is to get profit. Is it so?
Yes, because if you look at it, if you put it into the context of the strategic plan, is that the strategy is to make money. Mm-hmm. Then the operational will be the particular area they're going to make money. Right, you know, selling clothes, selling cars, you know, how you say, selling sound, selling, you know, whatever it is. Then you're going to be, your technical is going to be then how you run that business and things like that. Mechanical will be down to, you know, how they, you know, the copy machine works and stuff like that. Does that make sense? So that's actually the thing. So what they're talking about is these mission statements and all that, then it's just a way to make people focus. But the actual point is it's money. I think it was, I can't remember who it was, if it was a Charlie Chaplin or something. It was one of those old, you know, old things, is that they had these big businessmen, I think in New York or someplace like that, or maybe it was Los Angeles. And so then, it wasn't a Chaplin. So then they're all sitting there in their suits and the top hats and everything's very formal, you know, all the wood, you know, how you say, everything, the walls and everything is all that old style of wood paneling and stuff like that. And then at one point they're going to start the meeting. So before they start the meeting, they have to, you know, show their reverence to the Supreme. So they all stand up and then they all look one direction, and there on an altar is a dollar sign. And then they all offer their reverence and all that, and then having done that, then they all sit down and then start business. So the point is, it's just about making profit. They don't make profit, it's not that they have something else to do. So that's the thing, is the economics is their goal. And so, but that's why we're saying is that the occupational is only a social position. The ashram is the spiritual position. Because in the ashram, then your goal is to, you know, attain to the Supreme or develop love for Krishna. Mm-hmm. Right? So, but to do that, you need facilities to live. Therefore, the occupation does that. Now, within that, then the business, it's so all of them are to make money. But the medium through which they make money, you know, or the reason they do, is then for business, it's profit. Mm-hmm. Right? And so what makes profit is then what you do. Right? For the Shudras, it's doing the work or skill that therefore pleases the businessman. That makes their profit. So in other words, the expression of their skill, their art, makes their profit. Because they're artists, so therefore expression of their art is what artists like to do. But that makes profit because that they'll pay for that. Government is protecting the people. They protect the people. It creates the environment in which it can be prosperous, and then when it's prosperous, then the tax can be taken to maintain the society. Right? Does that make sense? And then the Brahmins, then it's to study and teach. And then by doing that, then people being impressed, then they'll take care. So for business, profit is the direct, it's you could say it's the means, it's the goal. Does that make sense? Well, in other words, they have another goal and means, but it'll come as a side point, mm-hmm. like that. So, yes, you can't really say is that it's, because they'd have to say the mission statement is to make as much money as possible in, you know, whatever way it's practical. Now they can say is that, okay, the areas in which we want to, in other words, the operational, that they can start saying, that's how, you know, we want these kind of dealings, we want this kind of methods or these kind of areas. Yeah. So that would be their operational. That's the whole thing. What's the mistake is that they'll use these systems like the military or educational formulas for their success, but they're always dropped. It's always thinking, no, government works at this level, business works on this level. No, it drops down. It's never the same. Does that make sense? So when business uses strategic planning, then they'll bump from operational, they'll bump the operational or tactical up to strategy. But actually, they don't have, because technically, even you want to make money, you know, what's the purpose of making money? You know, like that, so you can, you know, maintain family, you can do these. In other words, I can maintain my religious life for that. You know, you can say, that's it. So I need to maintain my religious life. That's the strategy. What's the operational? I'm a businessman. I can do that through business, right? The Kshatriya do it through his things, the Brahmin through that, like that. Then, okay, I can do it through business. So what's the tactical? I can run this kind of business. What's the mechanical? Arranging all the facilities I need, a place and whatever is the ingredients used for that business to run. That would be the actual strategic planning. But, you know, then it makes the business, you know, the business dealings look, it's mechanical, it's the lowest level. Well, they want to move that up. It feels bad because it's a social position. People want more social prestige. Does that make sense? So that's how it works. It makes people. But from the Vedic, you would want to put everything in perspective so everybody knows what they're dealing with. So in the Vedic system, someone, let's say, who is a businessman, knows they're a businessman. And they're comfortable with that because that's their nature. That's what they can do. They can maintain themselves. And with that, they can do their devotional life. They can do things that are religious. They can give in charity. They can themselves take part in their devotional activities, because on the devotional platform, it doesn't matter what your karma is. When it comes to ashram, it doesn't matter. right? The rules of husband and wife or sadhana are the same for everybody. So there's no difference there. So it's not that, you know, who leads the kirtan, it's not according to what varna you are. You know, though it's a funny thing, is the Vaishyas generally have a better voice than the others. You know, artists, if they have a good voice, they'll have a really good voice. And the others, if they have a good voice, they'll be there. But as a general rule, Vaishyas generally have a good voice. Some don't, but generally they do, because of the nature of to be successful in business, that there's some position of Venus in the chart, and Venus then makes for a good voice. So that's why you see a lot of in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan, many of the main kirtan leaders are all Vaishyas, like that. So it's just by nature that they can do. But that would be because they have a good voice, not because they're a Vaishya. You know what I'm saying? So, but in Varna side, you do business because you're a businessman. It means if you're not a businessman, you can't do business. And if people say, no, but everybody's equal, you should be able, anyone can do anything, that's nonsense. And any practical person in the world knows it's nonsense. I can remember when was that? 6 months, 9 months ago, there was this interview with somebody who was quite successful. And a young guy, I think one of the things is it was a study in all these young people who are successful. Rather than, you know, because generally we hear about the 50, 60 year olds, but this is all about the late 20s, early 30s, this kind of area. And then they were asking him about, because I think it was all during the, all the American presidential campaigning and all that, so then the political thing will be, you know, topical. So they ask him what's his, you know, how does he stand politically? Is he a liberal or conservative? He says, when it comes to social issues, I'm liberal, but when it comes to economic, I'm conservative. Because only the conservative works, you know. So when it comes to money, I'm realistic. And then when it comes to social, I'm idealistic. Does that make sense? Yeah, so if it's appreciated, then in reality, what is called the mission statement will be more down on the operation or tactical level. So as long as they understand is that if it doesn't make profit, it's not business, then you can look at these other things. At the same time is, then there's a reason why you have to make profit. That's why he's saying, I even drop that down to the operation, you know, is that because of maintaining a lifestyle. And that means then you have character and quality. So I can't make money that's actually going to be bad for character or the lifestyle, like that. Then within that, then which area you can make money, and then it moves down from there. So in doing that, I would say is that bring out that these higher levels are there. You know, in other words, the mission statement's there. It focuses them on the specifics of the business and the effort. But they have to know is that the profit has to be there, and personal development has to be there, and then it will be more complete. But the mission, so you don't hear people talking about mission statements so prominently. It's not that they don't do it; it's just not the new thing like it was back in the 90s. Everything had to have a mission statement. You know, you're cooking lunch. Well, what's the mission statement? You know, what are your objectives? You know, like this and that. Well, you know, I'm going to go into the kitchen, okay. But what are we going to accomplish by going into the kitchen? Well, then I'll be in the kitchen, okay. So, you know, you don't have to do all that jazz. So.
And the second question, I would like to understand and to get your explanation on the following problem of the leadership. I was following the election process in the United States for the sake to understand how powerful and wealthy people presents things, how they behave nowadays. So, and I, from the very beginning, I was on the Trump side, mm-hmm. because I saw that his qualities are much better than his opponents. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I was never saying that he is, from my opinion, he is a leader of the state. He just has very vivid qualities. Mm-hmm. And in such situation, when one person is, he can show his qualities, mm-hmm. but he is not fit for that particular position.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no other people, probably they have these qualities, but they are not so prominent.
Mm-hmm.
What is solution?
Solution, I'll tell you my mother's solution, is you vote for which one will be less bad. That's how you choose. They're both bad. That's standard.
Yeah.
But which one will be less bad is the one you go for.
But how can you not being qualified to understand all these?
Well, that's another thing. So then it will be subjective there.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so the people think that no, this is going to be changed. It's the same.
Yeah.
So the point, the advantage here that despite the insanity, like it means when it comes to general elections and that, unless it's some kind of more banana-y, republic-y kind of thing, then, you know, that everybody can see that things aren't going so well. But in, you know, what's generally considered the standard kind of world scene, then one could possibly say the American political scene is one of the most crazy that there is. Right, you know, it's standard, right? You know, they come up with Hollywood, everything else has to be similar, because Hollywood's only putting what goes on there onto film, right, you know, like that. But at the same time as you have this system, that of the democratic systems, then the organization of a democratic republic accord that was done by George Washington seems to be the most strong and stable of all of them that are there. Because the way he organized it, so he studied all the ones, and somehow or another he seemed to be quite qualified. He was a general, and that, so he could see the practical. And he was a field general, so he wasn't just an administrator. And from a young age, I think when he was a general, he was 21. When he was on the battlefield fighting for the, you know, American Red, he was 21 at the time. So it wasn't like he was really, you know, 50-year-old like that. So he was figuring all this out when he was young, and so putting that effort into it. Then he came up with this system of how the American government runs. So it's such a strong system that basically, despite who's there,
mm-hmm.
it'll still function. Because even though the president's there, like you see is in the campaign, how Trump is talking, right? He's completely, you know, wild, you know, says whatever he wants, doesn't. People like that because they're tired of political correctness. They want to know what they're getting and all that. So at least with him, what he says is what he's thinking. You know, whether he should be thinking that or whether he should be saying that, that's another thing. But the point is, you know what he says he's saying. While the other ones are saying one thing, you don't actually know what they're thinking. People, you know, get tired of that. But all that talk, all that, things like that, but as soon as you see he's in office and he's there, you don't hear him talking like that anymore. Why? Because there's systems in place to train you and see that you follow the protocol, the etiquettes, and everything like that. And so that you have in place. Because technically speaking, according to the American ideal, anybody could become a president. But, I mean, one of, I think, was it Carter? I think he was a peanut farmer, like that. And Reagan was an actor. You know, Schwarzenegger did pretty well. Both of them were in California, of course. You know? But so anybody could do, but the machinery that's in place then molds you so that you at least follow the, you know, the status quo. So that from that aspect, you're asking, how could he actually do something? Because all these other things that are in place and advising and that, because he may be the head of the military, but he doesn't run the military. Does that make sense? So it means he has the last say, but at the same time, as he's not the one that maintains things. He'll move on, the same people will be there, just like the White House. The butler's there, the presidents come and go, but the butler's the same guy, you know?
My question is more from that perspective. If I have to elect, let's say, a manager, and I face the same issue, yeah. how to decide?
Who would have the most potential?
Potential in which direction?
It means according to what's the Vedic standard.
Okay, got it. Yeah,
like that. Like I remember there was one thing that there was a choice for, okay, there was the head of a martial arts school, and they had so many students, and they wanted to have a successor. And so there were so many, all the senior students were there, but there was one student who wasn't senior, and they had picked them. And then the question, well, how are them, this and that? And their point was, is all these other students are good, definitely good, but they can't get any better. Well, this other student, they're younger, they're not as trained as them, but their potential is they could become much better than those others. So you have to basically look at what potential could be there. In other words, when they do go into that, you know, governmental machinery, what will they be able to do there? Will more be able to be brought out? So when it comes to the political and those kind of things like that, then yes, his opponent would have probably been better, because they're just more refined, more trained, been at it longer. In other words, they've been in the political field forever. I think they did start off as a lawyer, like that, did grow up, you know, they were in the scene, while he was just a businessman the whole time. So, but when it comes down to practical stuff, he'll have the strength, mm-hmm. like that. So the political machinery people will make up for, because it's politics, they have to do that. It means they write the speeches anyway, like that. But when it comes to the practical, then he'll have that potential in that aspect. But then it'll be seen how he does. You'll see at the end, and if he does very well, then people start thinking about, okay, people are more practical. If he fails miserable, then they'll go back to the politicians. They won't. They're not going to go for these guys anymore. So it'll just be seen, because you're not dealing with all the standard qualifications, training, and everything. So you don't know. So it's not like the people's representatives are picking. Mm-hmm. The president, because that would be more of a standard, because the people are there, they have their representatives, and those representatives have their representatives. At some point in there, when the training of the individual, knowledge of the individual is high enough, then you can say, as they understand what it takes to run the country, then amongst that group, they can elect mm-hmm. king. I think Poland had like that. The king wasn't just handed down from father to son. The nobility chose the king, you know, from amongst themselves, who they felt was the proper king. Then they became the king, because they knew what was happening in their kingdoms, you know, or their whatever it is, the area they managed. And so they knew how to manage, but at the same time, who could then understand and deal with everybody's, then that person would be elected. So that would be, but if not, then people have to be trained, so that the people themselves, if they have to choose, then they have to have enough training to know what to look for. But that's not part of the scene. You know? I mean, the journalists take it upon themselves, of course, to, in their own way, say that they're educating the people, but generally it's just pointing out faults and this and that. It's not actually education. Because if people were too educated, they wouldn't listen to the journalists either. Because, you know, they just find fault, and so, you know, where's the positive? Where's the knowledge? Where's the real, you know, substance? Yes.
What can I explain to a devotee the importance of the character who is very enthusiastic to preach? But at the same time shows very, very bad character, even very kind of obviously, but does not understand it and considers that he is discriminated and he is like badly treated by actually us who try to explain. Can you just...
What you can ask him is that certain behavior, is that what the Shastra authorizes? You know, you're doing certain things, how do you substantiate that you're doing it? You know, that's all. If the thing is, if they're being discriminated against, is explain how this particular activity actually is going to be useful in Krishna consciousness, and see what their explanation is. And most likely, and keep asking questions. And at one point, they're going to maybe have to agree if they're willing to go through such a process. But the point is if you have. They're preaching, and are they getting some results? No results. Yeah, so then that would be the reason that if they like to preach and they would like to get results, then the better the character, the better results, because you have influence by the strength of character. Like Prabhupada mentions about these Naistika Brahmacharis, they have so much influence. Like Narad Muni, he goes and talks to a hunter or a dacoit, right? And then they turn into great devotees. Or he takes a totally materialistic karmakanda, you know, personality like Prachina Bharhishad and turns him into a great devotee. That's because of character, that strength of character. You understand? So even you're a devotee, influence is affected by how strong the character is. So just from that, to be a good preacher, because generally say, oh, you have bad qualities, you should stop preaching. No, you should continue preaching, you should just improve the character, because, you know, sometimes. Does that mean? Is that okay? Okay, 59. Maharaj Prithu's intelligence and education were exactly like that of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death. His opulence was comparable to the Himalayan mountains, where all valuable jewels and metals are stocked. He possessed great riches like Kuvera, the treasure of the heavenly planets, and no one could reveal his secrets, for they were like the demigod Varunas. Right? Because remember, before I was talking about the ocean and all that, he was deep and grave, and then now we see is that now it goes further on that. So, in other words, the qualities of these eight different demigods that the king he has the qualities and represents, then Sukadeva Goswami is bringing them together in these very nice ways of grouping them so you can appreciate, you know, those things. Because it's not that this demigod has something that's totally different from that. They'll have the uniqueness, but there's many things that overlap. They have common. So the common points and the unique points are then being gathered together according to how they support each other. Does that make sense? Yeah. Purport. Yamaraj or Dharmaraj, as the superintendent of death, has to judge the criminal living entities who have committed sinful activities throughout their lives. Consequently, Yamaraj is expected to be the most expert in judicial matters. Prithu Maharaj was also highly learned and exceedingly exact in delivering his judgment upon the citizens. Right. So that principle is that this idea that everybody can judge in that, no, you actually have to be very intelligent and very educated and very exact means you have to have good qualities to be able to apply it. Because you're dealing with justice, it's very potent. And so if you deal correctly with it, everything goes right. You deal wrongly with it, everything goes bad. You know, it's like anything that has more potency, like fire. You deal properly with it, you get very good results. You deal improperly with it, it can be disastrous, the results. So that's how the judicial matters are. So like Yamaraj, he knows the most. Like Yamaraj, he has the largest Bhagavatam. But he has, like, we have, you know, the 10 avatars and a few other avatars are there. You know, Hamsa and a few others like that. So, dealing with, you know, that, because the purpose is mainly the spiritual understanding. But Krishna comes as all the species of life. He's the first one, he takes on that. And then he performs a pastime. So, then in Yamaraja's Bhagavatam, all those pastimes of all 8,400,000 are in his Bhagavatam, so that he can connect every situation, because he's taking all the living entities according to karma, putting them in the various bodies. He can always remember Krishna from the pastime of the Lord. Not just the mechanical that Krishna's in control, but from personally. Well, others then they have this and that, because there's, I think it's, I can't remember what it is, 2 billion verses in the Puranas. We have 400,000, right? And already we consider it so much. So he's got the biggest form of the of the Puranic literature. So that means he's most intelligent and most educated, like Vidura. He knew everything perfectly, how it should run, how it should be dealt. So he was there for the prime minister. But because of lack of Krishna consciousness and that, therefore, and lack of character, Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra couldn't actually take advantage of his advice. But he's the most qualified. So break here for a few minutes. So punishment, then you have to deal very nicely, properly with punishment. Because punishment, if it's meted out and it's inappropriate, then part of the reaction to that, to what was gone wrong, or what is the criminal activity, falls on the person who's punished. Right? So that's the whole point. If the person who did the wrong is dealt with appropriately according to what's the recommendation, and then 100% of the reaction of that sin falls on them. Now if it's adjudicated improperly, then a quarter falls on them, a quarter will fall on whoever makes the judgment, another quarter on those who are part of the thing or support it, and I think a quarter on whoever's connected to those people. Like that. So it goes out. So it's not just that you make a bad decision in punishment and it just affects you if it's wrong. It affects anybody connected with you. You know, I'm not sure if it goes out as far as, it bothers your dentist, but whatever it is, it will affect family. Like that. So therefore that's why he's saying that he is so intelligent and educated means that he could exactly punish. That's why he says exceedingly exact in delivering his judgment, right? So you know exactly what was wrong, and that poison itself, that's what was dealt with. That then gives the reaction, right? So that's what you're trying to do. So that means he's really, says here, was highly learned. That means he had the character, he had the knowledge, therefore he could apply it. So that's then the glory that's here from Yamaraj. No one could excel him in opulence any more than estimate the stock of minerals and jewels in the Himalaya mountains. Therefore, he's compared to Kubera, the treasure of the heavenly planets. Right? So he has so much, no one can even estimate the same time as the wealth that he has that is used and you can see, then it's like Kubera. Like Kubera is the treasure for the demigods. That means he'll deal with everything very properly. So how much he has, you can't tell, like the Himalayas, and what he uses then is done in a very proper way. You know what I'm saying? Treasures generally tend to be, deal with money very properly. So then his dealing with the money was all proper and everything like that, but the amount he has, you can't even estimate. Right? You just don't know. Like that. Because that's the thing, is if no one knows, it works better. Like the enemy knows that you have this much, then they know how much they can, they lay siege to your place, then you only have enough money to last 6 months. So therefore, if they just sit there for 6 months, then they have the kingdom. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But if they don't know, nobody knows, then there's a doubt. Because one is that it could be so much, it could be so little, but you generally tend to so much, right? Because otherwise people would know. And that you can't find out, that means he has better security, he has better organization than you have. So therefore then, just it's daunting, so people just won't bother you. Because, who wants to, stick their hand into something that could be like full of snakes or something? You just don't do it. Does that make sense? You have to have some idea. Nor could anyone discover the secrets of his life any more than learn the secrets of Varuna, the demigod presiding over the water, the night, and the western sky. Varuna is omniscient, and since he punishes sins, he is prayed to for forgiveness. He is also the sender of disease and is often associated with Mitra and Indra. Okay, so he's very, very powerful. Varuna is one of the 12 Adityas, so one of the 12 sun gods. Like that. He deals with the ocean, so therefore that depth, like the quality of the depth and inability to understand, that was then given before. you know, consideration of, you know, how he satisfies everyone's desires and everything like that. But in this one, then it's like, I say, no one can reveal his secrets like Varuna, right? Because the ocean is so deep, no one can know what's there. So that's very important. What is secret, what is necessary for national security, and that no one should know except for people who are dealing with it. You know, of course, there's always those, no, everything should be known. But if everything's known, how much of a country can you run? So in other words, only people who don't know how to run a country would say, no, there should be no secrets. So the problem with secrets is we're worried that people will use it badly. So that's why then there's the character. The character is good, then it doesn't matter, where you don't have a problem that someone has secrets. Right? If you're protected and everything's going to go well, the purpose of the kingdom is to protect the citizens, there's no problem with the king having secrets. Right? Because that's just how it works. It has to be like that. That makes sense. Yes?
I mean, there is a certain, what do you say, ideal in modern society, everything should be, you know, transparent and open and things like that. But is it so? Even the state might come up and show, okay, it's like this and like this. This is our treasure. But is it really like that?
So much has to be known is known. So yeah. If that's the stand, means if there's no problem for us to know that it's known. But when they say transparency, what do they mean? What is the definition of transparency? It's just facts. And since when are facts truth? You understand? Facts is one thing, truth is another. See, the modern things, when you're dealing with an atheistic perspective on society, where God's technically not included. You can use him as an excuse, but he's not included in the standards. It's not that it's God's standards. It's our standards. Otherwise, we say these are the social standards, but they don't meet the modern concept of standards. Then we'll say that they're wrong. But then how can we claim that we're functioning on God's standards? We should understand how they are, how they should be, why they're like that, educate ourselves. Because if we educate ourselves, we'll find that maybe they work. Because things that before they said, like we said before, you go to secular school, we don't need religious education. They dropped it, and then after 20 years, they figured out when kids are going crazy, so they have to reintroduce it. So that means maybe there's things they don't know, right? They're so proud of what they know. It's like I think it was in the 1890s, you know? How you say belly pock or whatever? How you say? Is that how you say? Yeah. Then they thought that they had man was at the pinnacle, and he had invented everything that could be invented. There is actually an idea to close the patent office because whatever could be invented has been invented. So that's the point. The man's false ego being so great. Then he unfortunately doesn't understand the actual reality of what's going on around him. Something he sees, he said, but he doesn't actually know more. So does that make sense? Yeah.
Just got a comment about transparency. Example in the business. By just observing figures given by a bookkeeper, no one can understand what's going on in business.
Yeah. Point is you. Yeah. Even on that, someone will. How do you define what's profit? You can write it in such a way that there's no profit.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, because everything, you know, the guy, you know, how you say. 50 workers breathing air, that's this much, and this and that, and so therefore if we count that, and you know, air costs us, you know, it's like you can get into anything, you know. And then there's the guys passing air, so that reduces the quality of air, so that's going to have an effect, so that's going to have all these repercussions of which then, you can really have fun, you know. So, but here they're making synonymous that facts and truth are one and the same, when they have nothing to do with each other. right? Because if you're looking at the facts from an atheistic point of view, how can it be truth? Because the Bhagavatam points, truth is what's connected to Krishna. So unless you see those facts connected to Krishna, they're not truth. They're actually illusion. You understand? So this whole modern thing of transparency, yes, you want transparency in the parampara, but that's philosophy. Have we ever said that what happens when you have a pond and you move the water? It's clear water. You take a stick and put it in and move it around. What happens? Right? It becomes cloudy. What's making it cloudy? The water? No, the dirt in the water. So therefore, the cloudy element is the mundane. Right? So in other words, if they want transparency and they want truth, that means you should be able to explain your accounts and your management according to Krishna consciousness. That is the statement that would be of value. Why these things were done, how they were used in Krishna consciousness. That's the whole thing. But to just see numbers and all that, it's like, who do we have there? An accountant? Name me the GBC who knows accounting. Name me, yeah, how many temple presidents know? You know, some do. It's a handful. You know, 600 centers, you're going to say they know? And then the people working with the accounts, how much do they know? So the whole point is that in reality, then if truth is not defined as what is Krishna conscious and connected to Krishna consciousness as recommended through the transparent parampara, then it's an illusion. That's the first thing that has to be understood. They say, well, no, we're talking management, but then that's just another illusion. Are we talking management? It's God's world. Are we actually talking management? What are God's laws on management? You can't discuss that. Oh, well, we don't know that. Then why not? You know all the other modern, success gurus and what they have to say. Why don't you know what the scriptures and Prabhupada says? So is that truth? That's illusion. So in other words, if we really want to get into truth, it's going to start looking really, really bad for people. So that's why we should stick to the standard point. What truth is means what's connected to Krishna. And then how an administration is going on in connection with Krishna. That then makes it very nice. That's something that then will be inspiring. Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, so like that, then Varuna, there's things that you can't, there are sometimes things that people can't know. People demand that they know. What's their responsibility to accomplish it? You say you want to know, what's your responsibility in the matter? Everyone wants to know how the temple's run. What's their responsibility to see if something goes wrong in the temple, they'll take responsibility? Never. So then, what's their right to know? They say, we have a right to know, we're a member of ISKCON. But do they? How does that work? So there's no private lives. We're such impersonalists. We're a personal movement. We're open. We're this and that. But are they? No, because no one has any personal life. So they're impersonalists. It's not Krishna conscious. It's not actually even viable on the social platform, and it doesn't function anywhere. Right? Does that make sense? The journalist who's out there yelling and screaming and demanding truth and transparency, you know, do we know about his life? You know, why is he an authority that what he says has an impact on society? What do we know about his life? Shouldn't it go through his life with a fine-tooth comb? You can say, no, but I'm just here as, you know, reporting like that, but you're having an effect. What you speak affects me. The editorial is there. How many people read that? So many people read that. So you have effect. What is the quality of their life? So those who like to talk, what is this quality of their life? Does that make sense? That has to be seen. Does that make sense? That's why every devotee, therefore, is trying in their own personal life to improve the quality of their own life and bring it more in line with Krishna consciousness. Then it has more value in the Krishna conscious movement, as we were discussing before, is that someone's preaching the quality of their personal life, that will make for the quality of the effect of their preaching. It means you're talking Krishna consciousness, But the point is it's Krishna being pleased with that, it has effect. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, as the quality of your own personal life improves, that means then your effectiveness will be greater. Right? Now, that means of what you're conscious of. So many people have so many habits that are great, but they're not really conscious of them. But it doesn't mean there's not an effect, you know, on themselves as far as reactions go. But what we're meaning is that what they're conscious of, they're trying to do that. Therefore, they can say, oh, but then how does a new devotee have effect in preaching? Because they have so many bad qualities. But as far as they're concerned, they're fully engaged in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, it has effect. Because they don't have anything else. But when they start introducing so many other things in their life are necessary and this and that, that's when it starts having less effect. Does that make sense? Yes?
Maharaj, can you elaborate more on the quality of life and developing of this quality? Like, what do you mean by that?
Means as Rupa Goswami is recommending that you perform devotional service conscious of Krishna, to please Krishna without karma and jnana. That you're seeing, okay, where is this aspect of karma and jnana in my life? You know, the acharyas say points, how do I improve on this? Like that. Does that make sense? So the recommendations within the devotional process. That's what we're talking about. You know, anartha nivritti. Because eventually we have to come up to the point that I'm not the controller and enjoyer. We have to give that one up. Does that make sense? Yeah. So giving that up, then it makes it a whole lot easier. As long as we maintain that, then it's going to have a specific manifestation. See, the troubles that we see, that's the specific manifestation. That's not actually the problem. Right? Someone has a, you know, people are going to have eating, sleeping, mating, defending, you know, dharma, artha, kama, moksha, they're going to have some attachment somewhere, right? So, where that attachment is, that's the secondary application of the primary, which is, I'm the controller and enjoyer. Right? So, I'm the controller, I like to control this, you know, therefore I can enjoy that. But so in other words, the principal point of our consciousness that I'm the controller and enjoyer has to have a secondary form to manifest it. Does that make sense? So what we see is actually not the main problem. The main problem is the sense that I am the controller and enjoyer. So only by chanting Hare Krishna and devotional service, that's the only way to get rid of that. We think when we get rid of the secondary, we solve the problem. That's why it points out so many times is that you can remove all these things, but then again, they come back. Does that make sense? So, that's why then Rupa Goswami gets the point, is if you have seeds, they'll sprout. Right? Given the right conditions. But if you take the seeds and either soak them in water or fry them, they won't sprout. I mean, soak means leave them in water, not leave them overnight and then they sprout. We're talking about you just leave them. So either through austerity, you know, and these kind of things, then they're roasted and all that, or by being absorbed in the nectar of devotional service, how they'll sprout. But the point is only devotional service can stop these seeds from sprouting. Any activity you do, it creates a seed. Right? Therefore, the desire to do it again is created. So you do something correct, the desire to do that stuff. You do something incorrect, the desire to do that again is also born. But if you do something devotional, then the desire to do more devotion increases. So as that increases and the others decrease, then we become fixed in devotional service. Does that make sense? So that's what we're trying to do. That's why the whole conversation is, you get into the technical, but you have to keep going back to the character and then to the devotional point to actually support it so it makes sense. Otherwise, some of these things, you know, won't make sense. These specific, you know, mechanical or tactical elements. So it makes sense. So when you go back, you have to go back to the Krishna conscious aspect. And when you go back to the Krishna conscious aspect, that's where we started. So that's why that's first. So the primary, if that's situated, you understand it, then we can discuss secondary. Because then we either understand it in context of the primary, or we can discuss it so that we understand it in context of the primary. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
So is it like in the beginning of spiritual life we are kind of innocent and sincere, or
yes.
maybe, and then everything works, even though we may be impure. But when this innocence is sort of like lost, that we, we become familiar maybe with the situation and start again the same conception of interior control, then our effectiveness is much less.
Yes. Yeah. In other words, when that enthusiasticness is there up to Bhajana Kriya, then it works very nicely. But if we're not continuing the process through anartha nivritti with that focus, then we may get distracted by those things that come up in anartha nivritti. I mean, it's, in other words, all these desires within the heart, they're there from previous activity. So they're all impressions within the heart. Now, as we go in devotional service, all those things will come up to the surface. You know, as the example of we have the pond, it looks clean, but as soon as we agitate it, you find out it's not clean. Right? It's just all this dirt settled down into the heart. Right? So as it comes up, if you're focused on, you know, not being distracted by karma or jnana, then we let go of those things, and then they're gone. Right? Because in the cleaning process, you have to bring it out where you see it. Right? You have a closet full of all kinds of stuff. Then to be able to clean that closet, you have to actually visibly look at everything in the closet. So that's all that's happening in the process of anartha nivritti, is by the chanting process, by the devotional process, all this dirt is coming up, so you can see it. It's on its way out. But if in seeing it you go, oh, I wondered where that's been, it goes back into the closet. Or, wow, that's nice, where'd that come from? It goes back into the closet. You understand? So you have to let all the things go. So what's happening is that we're going along devotional service, then all these desires come up. And if we're just so confident that I'm doing devotional service and we aren't careful, then these things come up, we'll think they're great ideas, and the next thing we know, we're distracted. Does that make sense? But if we're careful, then we see they come up, then we let them go. Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing. Then these seeds get removed. Because those things are there, and we see in the seed. So you think, oh, that's nice, it sprouts. That's kutaj. Right? The first thing is there's that desire. When that desire coming up, then we deal with it, or have an interest, it sprouts, right? And then from sprouting, then it will grow, and then it will give us results, right? And when it's given the results, that's finished, but the point is any action you perform produces a new seed, therefore the process goes on. But if you don't take interest in these seeds, they don't sprout. So that's the point. Devotional service keeps these seeds from sprouting. So even though they're there, they can have no function. That's the example of the poisonous snake with no teeth. He may see still poisonous, but he can't bite you. Is that so? Yeah. So. So here, Varun is omniscient, so therefore then Pritumaras is able to see. He knows based on the Shastras and experience and advice of others, then what's going on. And therefore then he's, you know, has to be one to also deal with properly. In his bodily strength, though, this is verse 60. In his bodily strength and in the strength of his senses, Maharaj Pritu was as strong as the wind, which can go anywhere and everywhere. As far as his tolerance was concerned, he was just like the all-powerful Rudra expansion of Lord Shiva, or Sadashiva. In his bodily beauty, he was just like Cupid, and in his thoughtfulness, he was like a lion. In his affection, he was just like Swayam Bhuvamana. And in his ability to control, he was like Lord Brahma. is thoughtfulness seems like a Mayan. So that means when Mayans are sitting around, it's not that they're lazy, they're being thoughtful. But, so someone asks him, well, why are you sitting there? I'm being thoughtful. Yeah. So did you vacuum the rug? No, I'm still thinking about it. Yeah, so, yeah. In his personal behavior, Prithu Maharaj exhibited all good qualities, and in spiritual knowledge, he was exactly like Brihaspati. In self-control, he was like the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. As far as his devotional service was concerned, he was a great follower of devotees who were attached to cow protection and the rendering of all service to the spiritual master and the Brahmanas. He was perfect in his shyness and in his gentle behavior, and when he engaged in some philanthropic activity, he worked as if he were working for his own personal self, right? So he wasn't doing it with pride and things like that. Right? Purport. When Lord Chaitanya talked to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the Lord honored him as the incarnation of Brihaspati. Brihaspati is the chief priest in the heavenly kingdom, and he's a follower of the philosophy known as Brahmavada or Mayavada. Brihaspati is also a great logician. It appears from this statement that Maharaj Prithu, although a great devotee, constantly engaged in the loving service of the Lord, could defeat all kinds of impersonalists and Mayavadas by his profound knowledge of Vedic scriptures. We should learn from Maharaj Prithu that a Vaishnava or a devotee must not only be fixed in the service of the Lord, but, if required, must be prepared to argue with the impersonalist Mayavadis with all logic and philosophy, and defeat their contention that the absolute truth is impersonal. Right? So it's not enough to say, oh, well, I don't know that area. Right? Does that make sense? It means when it comes to the philosophy, all the devotees should know that, because that's an ashram aspect. Where you are performing, in this case, you know, like Maharaj Prithu, he's performing administration as his occupation. But it doesn't mean that he, from the ashram side, wasn't studied and learned it. So to say, oh, I'm a manager, you know, I don't know all this stuff. No, that's, we're not a manager. We're the soul. We're not the body. So therefore, we can learn all those things. And then in the application of our service, then we try to apply. Does that make sense? So in other words, we have to be able to lead in devotional service, and then we're organizing that, you know, for that purpose. Right? We're involved in the preaching, or involved in organizing so that preaching goes on, but if we need, we can do, because that's a higher thing. Does that make sense? There's no problem in doing something higher, but, you know, not to. Does that make sense? Yeah, so here's Lord Chaitanya when he talked to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who's very respectful. He's the Supreme Lord, but he's still respecting him as Brihaspati. So that's the whole point, is that a position that's respectable is always respectable. But it's not that there's not a position that's more respectable. Right? So Lord Chaitanya is respecting Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya as Brihaspati. You have to admit he is a respectable position. Right? But at the same time, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, even though he's Brihaspati, he is respecting Lord Chaitanya as the Supreme Lord. Does that make sense? So that means when we're managing doing these things, then we are respecting others for whatever is their particular ability in that area. And we deal with them on that respectful platform. But they may be respecting the manager because he may be in a higher position than him. Does that make sense? That's always the way it works. You have to respect someone for what they're actually, their particular, you know, outstanding feature is. Not that, oh, my position is superior, therefore I don't have to acknowledge that. Because then what we're doing technically is we're not acknowledging Krishna's position, how he's entered that thing. But he is that knowledge, he is that potency, whatever it is. So he's also our potency, but that means he's also that other person's potency. So we're not proud because we understand it's Krishna's potency, and the other person representing that potency of Krishna, we're respectful towards that. Then, therefore, we can respect all others and not expect respect for ourselves. That's how it works, because we see everything in relation to Krishna. Yeah. Yeah. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ideal self-controller or brahmacharya. When Krishna was elected to be president of the Rajasuya Yajna performed by Maharaj Yudhishthira, Grandfather Bhishma Dev praised Lord Krishna as the greatest brahmacharya. Because Grandfather Bhishma Dev was a brahmacharya, he was quite fit to distinguish a brahmacharya from a vyabhichari. Oh, that's what it is, a vyabhichari. Because I remember it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that Shantipur is famous for fine cloth and Vaishnava aparad.
Shantipur.
Okay. Here's the word. Okay. Although Prithumaraj was a householder and father of five children, he was still considered to be most controlled. One who begets Krishna conscious children for the benefit of humanity is actually a brahmacharya, right? So Manu mentions that. If someone follows the rules of having children, then one is considered a grihastha brahmacharya. So he's still a brahmacharya, right? He's not a sense enjoyer. So then that still works. So then he is, and then Krishna is the greatest brahmacharya. Maybe he's saying, but he, you know, what about, you know, 16,108 queens, you know, millions of gopis? How is he a brahmachari, right? That's because his senses are controlled. But that he's only interacting based on the principle, you know, of what is the relationship between the devotees. So then those in the conjugal rasa, because that's how they express their devotion to Krishna, it's not about the conjugal aspects that attracts Krishna, right? So it's not that the beauty of the gopis, their physical beauty is what attracts them. It's the devotion that they express. It happens to be expressed through that physical aspect. But it's the devotion that's attractive, not the physical. Because we have to remember is their beauty is actually just one of his energies. So it's already him. You know what I'm saying? So it's not that he's attracted by that, because it's already him. You know, so we're not talking about in the morning, you look in the mirror and go, well, you're quite handsome. You know, so we're not talking about that stuff. You know, because in any case, even Krishna, it's still him. So even if he's attracted by himself. But the point is that's not the attractive feature. Because just as, I think it was, when Narayan Rishi, they were performing their austerity. And anybody who does really serious austerity, then Indra gets worried. So then he sends down his soldiers, right? You know, the apsaras and all those kind of. Everybody comes down. And so then, and with them, he was a little worried. He came himself, you know, just to make sure everything was going to go right. And then when the apsaras start dancing and doing all the things that they do, then Narayan, he just took his hand and just hit his thigh, because they're sitting and meditating, so he just hit his thigh. From his thigh came thousands of apsaras that were so much more beautiful than these apsaras, because these are the best in the universe, right? And so much more beautiful that, you know, thousands of times, that they felt ashamed, you know? And so they just stopped. They're just like, you know. So the point is that, you know, you're trying to attract me with your feminine beauty. He's the source of feminine beauty. Right? And then Indra, he's so bewildered, he's just watching, oh, wow, he's so amazed. And then having come out and then, you know, everything's been set into proper place, they all start going back into his thigh. Right? And so he's just watching, you know, like that. And then as the last one is going back into his thigh, she just put her, you know, just stepped like that. Then he goes, wait, wait, wait. Give me one. One. Like that. So then she didn't enter. So she said, so that's Urvasi. Ur means thigh. So the resident of the thigh. So that's Urvasi. So that's why she's in her own category. When it says the five main apsaras, then sometimes they'll count her name, but they may not count her name because she's not technically not the top five. She's beyond the top five. So, just depends how you want to make your list. So, that's the whole point. Therefore, he's the greatest brahmacharya because he controls the senses. He has nothing to gain from the material world, you know, like that. Nothing you can gain from his internal potency. It's only devotion that attracts him. And so that devotion is expressed through the engagement of the senses, therefore the whole spiritual culture. And when we're interested in that spiritual culture, without Krishna, that becomes the material. So in other words, it's the same thing. I want the spiritual facilities and results. Without Krishna, that's the material world. So that means if Krishna is transcendental and beyond, that means he's not interested in the spiritual activities and results either. He's only interested in the devotion that's expressed through those spiritual activities and results. Does that make sense? Yes? So therefore, he's the greatest brahmacharya. And Bhishmadev, who no one can say he's not a good brahmacharya, right? That means even the demigods were impressed. So then, if he says he's the greatest brahmachari, now there's authority. Right? Okay. Although, one who simply begets children like cats and dogs is not a proper father. The word brahmachari also refers to one who acts on the platform of Brahman, or devotional service, right? So the brahmachari means one is functioning on the platform of Brahman. Thus, Preetra Maharaj was an ideal. In the impersonal Brahman conception, there is no activity. Yet when one performs activities in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is known as a brahmachari. So in other words, devotees are technically brahmacharis because they're only interested in performing activities in connection with Brahman. Does that make sense? Thus, Preetra Maharaj was an ideal brahmachari and grihastha simultaneously. Vishvakshen Nanu Vartishu refers to those devotees who are constantly engaged in the service of the Lord. Other devotees must follow in their footsteps. So those who are always following, we follow in their footsteps. So that's why we don't make things up. This idea is, oh, but we have to follow the modern. Well, whose footsteps are they following in? Right? Other gross materials. Who's enjoying? In other words, who's successful in the material world on the level of enjoyment? That's who they're trying to follow. So is that the lineage we want to be connected to? Or those who are actually brahmacharis, that everything is connected to the Supreme Lord. So then personalities like Preetra Maharaj are that we're trying to follow their example. Because that example will take us back to Godhead. All these other examples will take us to hell. Right? And there's a good chance we won't end up using the bucket. They already have the bucket. So, you know what makes sense? Yeah. And that's a problem. Other devotees must follow in their footsteps. Srila Narottam Das Thakur said, Hi Gosai Jar Mui Taro Das. He is prepared to become the disciple of anyone who follows in the footsteps of the six Goswamis. And so the six Goswamis are there. Who's following the six Goswamis, he wants to serve them. So that's our point. We're the servant, the servant, the servant. So the six Goswamis are there. The previous Acharyas are serving the six Goswamis. Prabhupada is then giving us, showing us how to do that. So those who then are following what Prabhupada says. And that, in serving the previous Acharyas headed by Rupa Goswami, that's who what we want to be connected. That's our whole point, because we want to be in the same position as brahmacharya. We want that we are absorbed in Brahman. Our service, our devotion, our activities are all connected to Brahman. Therefore, that's where brahmacharya comes in. Does that make sense? Yeah, that's the position. Also, like all Vaishnavas, Maharaj Preetra was devoted to cow protection, spiritual masters, and qualified Brahmins. Preetra Maharaj was also very humble, meek, and gentle, and whenever he performed any philanthropic work or welfare activity for the general public, he would labor exactly as if he were attending to his own personal necessities, right? So here, that aspect of respect, so therefore, cow protection and spiritual master qualified Brahmins, those who are therefore functioning in that capacity or serving in that capacity, then he would want to be also included in that service. So either serving them directly, serving those who are serving them. Right? Does that make sense? So he wants to see that he's always respecting superiors. That's what makes him such a good administrator. He has that appreciation of what's important. Then when he's dealing with those who is the general public, he deals as if it's only for his own, as if it's his own personal necessities. Otherwise, you see, it's not an uncommon concept that the person is really rich and that he's doing welfare work, but he carries that attitude, is that he's special and the other people are getting the benefits. So there's no, he doesn't deal nicely, right? But the point is here is when he's doing these things, he deals as if he's doing this for himself. So with that enthusiasm, he takes care of things for everybody. Right? That's the whole point. So whatever's done is done in that attitude. That's very important. In other words, his philanthropic activities were not for the sake of show, but were performed out of personal feeling and commitment. Right? It wasn't about getting the big, you know, 2 meter, you know, long check that you sign and everything's in front of cameras and all that, and shaking hands and all that kind of jazz. That wasn't what it was for. It was for the point of that it's being done to please the Lord. All philanthropic activity should be thus performed. So that's how it's all being done. So we do everything very nicely. Right? Even we go out and distribute prasad, we should distribute it properly. You know, caring, dealing nicely, not that, okay, these are, you know, people have no facilities and so we're better. No, it has to be that we're dealing nicely and giving nicely. Something so, you know, it's said in Manu. Even let's say you had extra food left over, extra prasad, and you're putting it out for the animals. You can't throw it on the ground. Because the point is, you know, they're also living entities. You have to deal properly. Just because they're an animal and that you throw it on the ground, they're not going to get upset. But the point is they're Krishna's living entities. Krishna in the heart sees how you deal, so you have to go and put it properly. So it says you can't just go out and toss it like that. You have to put it down properly. So they may be eating off the ground, but the point is you have to put it nicely on the ground. You can't just toss it on the ground. So even for animals, you have to deal properly. Let alone for humans, let alone for the Vaishnavas, let alone for the senior Vaishnavas. Does that make sense? Okay, and then the last verse says, throughout the whole universe, in the higher, lower, and middle planetary systems, Preeta Maharaja's reputation was loudly declared, and all ladies and saintly persons heard his glories, which were as sweet as the glories of Lord Ramachandra. Purport. In this verse, the words Srinam and Rama are significant. It is the practice amongst ladies to hear and enjoy the praises of certain heroes. From this verse, it appears that Preeta Maharaja's reputation was so great that ladies all over the universe could hear of it with great pleasure. At the same time, his glories were heard all over the universe by devotees, and they were as pleasing as Lord Ramachandra's glories. Yeah. So this point of the glory, so that great personalities are appreciating, and that the women are appreciating, then you know that something's going properly. Because therefore, those who are working in the field, and they know it, right, says the saintly persons, they know the standards, so then they deal in that particular way. Then it's appreciated, right? Because they can see what's actually proper. And then the women have a tendency that if something's done that's very nice and out of, you know, how you say, above the standard, out of the ordinary, then they want to talk about it, right? But that's the whole point. In a sense, they're going to talk about things, then it should be something good. Right? It's out of the ordinary, and it's bad. Women will still talk about it, but better is that, you know, that there's things going on nicely, then they'll talk about the out of ordinary stuff that's there. So, in one sense, you could say, why is it that many of these standards aren't established, you know, we see generally established? Because the women aren't impressed, so therefore they're not talking about it, therefore it does not spread. Does that make sense? So when the leaders of society, they're impressed with it, and by performance of them, the women are impressed, then you'll see it will go, because who will the women influence? Right? Everybody else. So therefore, their family members, they're going to influence. They think something's good, they're going to influence. Does that make sense? And the saintly persons and the leaders, they're going to influence. So therefore, at the grassroots level, the women will influence, and from the higher level on down, then the other qualified persons will influence. Lord Ramachandra's kingdom is still existing, and recently there was a political party in India named the Ram Rajya Party, which wanted to establish a kingdom resembling the kingdom of Ram. Unfortunately, modern politicians want the kingdom of Ram without Ram himself. Right? That is, people want that people will deal with these qualities, all the facility will be there, everything will be nice, but they don't want Lord Ramachandra, they just want that. So we see that all these great personalities, then it means all these big influential personalities that were materialistic, then they want to take over and have these facilities. But they're not willing to be God conscious also. That's why in the earlier discussion that one is going to have these positions of, if we want to have influence on the society and all that, you have to have the spiritual also. You can't just say, oh, we'll just talk about the good qualities and this and that, because as people get materialistic, it always will go down. Only if it's spiritual does it go up. So if you want society to progress and move up, you have to have the spiritual aspect. Otherwise, just the material, even you focus on good qualities, it's still, those good qualities will have good work, that will get good facility, that good facility will get sense gratification, people will be distracted because the consciousness is moving down. Right? But if the spiritual is kept, then you can keep that always on a proper platform and progress. Does that make sense? So you can't not have, you can't, oh no, we'll arrange these nice facilities. Unless what's the God consciousness connected with those nice facilities, it won't work. It can't work. One can say, no, but we can do it. But if materialists over the last 5,000 years can't do it in the West, why would we be able to do it? You understand? So, therefore, the only way to establish is through Krishna consciousness. That's all. Then, those qualities can be maintained and gained. And then, one can perform the proper activities that are recommended. And then, one will have facility that then one can engage in the Lord's service. Does that make sense? Although they have banished the idea of God consciousness, they still expect to establish the kingdom of Ram. Such a proposal is rejected by devotees. Preacher Maharaj's reputation was heard by saintly persons because he exactly represented Lord Ramachandra, the ideal king. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fourth canto, 22nd chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Preacher Maharaj's Meeting with the Four Kumaras. So we see here is that then practically, in the dealing in all different aspects, how he dealt. But we can see it's based on his Krishna consciousness. That's why it opens with Krishna consciousness, gives the detail as the Kshatriya, application, and then ends with this Krishna consciousness. Because that's the whole point. One can only make these things work because of Krishna consciousness. Why? Because these things are coming from Krishna's nature. So if one's not connecting to Krishna, one can't actually maintain these things. Does that make sense? So people will say, it's Kali Yuga, we can't follow all these things. Then our only point is, yes, we can't follow all these things because it's Kali Yuga. Means we don't have the qualifications. So it's not that Varnashram is old and archaic, that's why it can't be followed. We actually don't have the physical or psychological ability to follow it. We're just so unqualified. Manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya. We're so unfortunate. That's why we can't follow it. Not that, oh, it's archaic, it can't be used, as if it was usable, of course we could use it, but it can't be used, so we can't. No, we are totally unqualified. So now what's the solution? Because following the modern dharmic thing is not worked out for us or anybody else, because if it was working, guaranteed we wouldn't have joined Krishna consciousness. Right? But we join because it's not working. Right? We have to remember that point. Right? So then what to do? It's not that in Kali Yuga you can't follow it. Right? It's that in Kali Yuga people are unqualified to follow. In other words, the rules apply just as well as they do in other ages, but people aren't qualified enough to follow the rules. That's the problem. So how do you develop qualities that by your karma you don't have? And that's only by devotional service, because by devotional service, one automatically develops all the qualities of the demigods. Right? So that means the better you practice devotional service, the better the qualities that you have, therefore the better you can apply the application of the Varnashram system, and therefore get the best results, because no, nothing's going to get better results than the Vedic system. Does that make sense? So that's the whole idea. So it's not that, oh, it's called a yuga, we can't follow the Vedic system. It's the only way we can do is Krishna consciousness. So we can't just say, oh, we chant, we don't follow the rules, meaning I don't follow the devotional rules or the material rules, then how are you going to get anything? So we can only follow, by following the spiritual rules, then we'll have the qualification we can follow the material rules. That makes sense? So, in other words, it's the opposite of what people generally think. Right? That makes sense. It's only because we're devotees we can follow Varnashram. Because otherwise, if it wasn't for devotional service, we'd be malechas and yamanas. Nothing more. Possibly less, but not more. Right? Because that's because we notice that it says there's the 12 tribes, and it describes them. And then after having described them, it says, or lower. Yeah. So we have to remember, it is possible to go down from there. But, you know, yeah.
Which are these tribes?
You know, the Hundas, Palindas, Savaras, you know, that mentioned, the Bhagavatam mentions, like that, or lower. So when you start mixing these tribes, that's when you start getting lower. You know, so when you're, are you saying? Yeah, you know, because you have the Turks and the Greeks, and they're the you know, how you say, the Yavanas, you know, here, and you know, so you have all these different, the Hunas, you know, and so as you start mixing these, then you get or lower. You know, so you can say America is the great melting pot or lower. So they go beyond all, break through the boundaries of ethnicity, and so then to get to go to lower and lower heights of lowness. Yes. Yes.
You spoke about this offering of respect, and also the good breeds good. So if we continue offering respect to everybody, so then even those who are not respectful at the present will gradually become respectful, isn't it?
It's up to them, they're an individual. See, we shouldn't be doing something, it means it's a side point that by you being respectful, they'll become respectful, but the main point is by you becoming respectful, then you bring yourself that closer to the always kirtaniya sadhari, always being able to chant. So we're doing it because this is what's recommended, and that's why, and what Lord Chaitanya and the Acharyas say. So then we're trying to do it because it will please them. Now, along with it is a benefit, then that'll have influence on others, then that's practical. But we shouldn't be looking at it simply from that practical point of view. Otherwise, then how sincere will be our attempt at respect? That's why Brahma said it wasn't. For the sake of show, philanthropic activities were not for the sake of show. Right? So it shouldn't be that it's just for show that we're being respectful. It should actually be we are respectful. So that's the fun part, is when you're doing what you're supposed to do, you get the result of what the activity is for. But if you want that result, you can't get it. So that's the whole problem, is we want to be in control of it and we want to enjoy it. But if you're in control, the enjoyment's from the other party. And if you're enjoying, you're not in control. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, okay, you have the parent and the small child. Who's in control? Right? The parent. Who's it about? The child. So therefore, who are you trying to please? The child. But we want to be the child and in control. Right? I think they even recently made a movie out of that. Right? So that's the whole problem, is that we want the impossible. You can't have both. That's the thing, we want both. Right? Or to put others into the position they have nothing. Right? Because the point is, they're junior, it's about them. You're saying, okay, the kids are you have parents and you have two kids, then it's about the kids. Parents are in control, but it's about the kids. Right? Or you have husband and wife, you know, husband's in control, but it's about the wife. Does that make sense? You know, or government's in control, but it's about the citizens. That's how it works. So there's always this thing that all being control and it's about me. But that's already the position of a dependent. Right? So that's the problem, is that we're claiming independence, but we're acting from a position of dependency. The attitude is as someone who's dependent. You know, I have to demand that everybody respects me. You know, why don't I act in such a way that they do respect? Does that make sense to you?
The context like that, actually, it's bad for progress of Krishna consciousness when devotees are not respecting each other, not recognizing the authorities. So that's why one feels, oh, how can we do get anything together if there is such atmosphere? So it's maybe not exactly because of me, but maybe because of the whole thing.
You can, yes. But the point is therefore you should be doing it so that's because who can you influence the easiest, right? Yourself. So if you follow it, then you can talk about it. In other words, train others in it. But if you're following it, then you can do it nicely. You can't train somebody in something that you're not doing. Doing means that you're attempting to do it. Just like the neophyte devotee is trying to be Krishna conscious. It's not that they are the greatest devotee, but it has the effect. They can make others, they can preach and make others into devotees. You understand? But that's because they're trying for it. So in other words, an area that you're preaching in has to be an area that you're trying to understand, that you're trying to practice. Even if you're not perfect at it. And that as you become better at it, then the results become better. Does that make sense? So it's going to be you following it and you teaching it. So you following it becomes others' example. Not that you're doing it and, you know, and setting the example. No one likes that example. You know what I'm saying? No one likes the example where the person setting the example knows that they're setting the example. It's just like, it's just, no one likes it. So it has to be you're following it. That's what sets the example. Because when you're trying to set the example, everyone knows you're trying to set the example. So no one actually looks at the example. They only notice that you're trying to set the example. But if you're actually following it, then they see the example. Something else. Yes.
Maharaj, regularly I see devotees, especially before general elections, should they vote, not vote, if vote, then for whom? And, you know, there are different parties. What would be your advice to devotees?
It means voting? Technically, if we don't get involved in the voting, it's not a problem. Because for us, does it really matter? Right? So for us is that we're going to perform our activities. So as long as the governance allows those activities to go on, what does it matter which party is there? Does that make sense? Only if it would have an influence on one party will be more supportive, another party won't, then you have a value to voting. You understand? From the devotional point of view. So devotionalist means you can either not get involved or get involved if it will have an effect. only if you want to, as a citizen of the country, therefore then you want to vote for who would be closer to the proper, you know, standards, as is mentioned here, Peter Marsh, of who of the party is closer to that. And then if neither are closer to that, which one is least, you know, farthest away from that? You know what I'm saying? In other words, both are bad, which is the least bad. If you feel that you have a social obligation and all that, you're living there, you're doing things, then you can do it. From that, as a citizen, because it's part of the, you know, citizen, in the sense it's a democracy, citizenship, are supposed to vote. But most don't. Like, I think a typical American presidential election, I think only 40% of the people, of the whole population, actually vote. So that means 60% doesn't vote. So you don't vote. I don't think it's going to, it's not that your vote's going to throw it one way or the other. Does that make sense? So it's just, how are you looking at it? As a devotee or as a citizen? But still, as a citizen, still you're a devotee, so you have to use your comparison has to be according to the devotional standards. You know, what does the Vedas recommend? Can't be, well, you know, I like the guy's hairdo or something. That definitely wouldn't have worked on the last one. Is that okay?
Yes. Maharaj, in the purport, verse 56, taxes were mentioned, and I would like to ask, what is the Vedic principle of taxation in terms of, there is discussion in the society, for instance, in our country, now taxes, everyone is taxed equally, a certain percentage of one's income. But then there is another approach, the bigger the income, the higher the taxes. What's Vedic principle?
Vedic principle is, you have, means if you're talking about a generic tax, it'll be the same for everyone, if you're working on that. Because the point is, somebody who's richer, they're paying more tax anyway, but in proportion to what they make, it's the same. So the general standard is a sixth, right? Because that's how much karma the government takes on. So therefore, I think that 16.5% is the standard. Mm-hmm. Only in times of emergency, then they can increase that to 25%. So the Prabhupada, you know, generally it's always emergency, Prabhupada mentions 25%. But it would fluctuate between those. So that's a generic way of looking at it. The Brahmins aren't taxed, right? And so only those who are generating money, they're taxed. So in the Vedic sense, you know, the people who work in an office would be taxed. The profit, you know, they would be paid for what is worth, and the business would pay tax. So now it's like the business hands on the money, and then the individual person then has to pay his tax, but before it would be is he only gets salary, like that, and the businessman gets tax. So only if you're generating income or profit, you know, like the farmer, he farms and then there's results from the field, then a percentage of that would go. Like that. That's how it would work. But if you're only working for somebody, then you're not taxed.
It's not considered income. It's not considered income, salary.
It is, but you're not generating money.
Okay.
You're only taking part in the process. It means the business is generating the money, therefore the business is taxed.
But then there is no such term as income tax in the Vedic.
No, it's income, meaning who's, or you could say profit tax, like that. They also have, based on that, you also have your. So that can be those which are fixed and regular, but then you have people who are bringing things from other places and things like that. So that then is another point that comes up, is that those are revenues. There's a few different things. You have the taxing, you have the revenues, and you have something else, fines. So someone's bringing something from somewhere else, so therefore, because it comes into your state, or you know, wherever that governance is, therefore, because it may be generated in another state, but when it comes into your state, then it's taxed there. Okay. But that depends upon also, you know, how you say, the consideration. So what I said was the generic. Then you start getting into the specifics of what you're dealing with. So in this case of bringing in revenues from outside, then it'll be where they brought it from, you know, what it took to do that, protect it, keep it, you know, all the different things like that. That all has to be looked at. So you can't just give it a standard thing. It has to be, is that someone just, let's say, bought, you know, pumpkins from just across the border. You know, so then he goes over in the morning, he comes back in the afternoon. You know, how much investment is there in transportation and all that? So it'd be minimal. So then the tax doesn't have to be, the tax will be your set thing. It doesn't have to be lowered by that. So then let's say if you're saying that, you know, whatever it is, your tax on it, then it'd be, and the pumpkins are worth this much, so they could get this much, then this is the tax, right?
Yeah.
Now, let's say he's brought their very special pumpkins, and they're from a very far off place, and this and that, and so many things. So then they can be sold for this much, these pumpkins. And so therefore there's this much tax, right? They're special pumpkins, they can be sold for more, so that would be more tax. But now you have to take off all the transportation, keeping it, all the different things, expenses that went into from the point where he bought it to the point where the market is. You have to remove all that as a government. So that would come out of that tax part. Mm-hmm. So then let's say you apply that, you know, 16.5% tax. And so therefore, if it was just a local thing, then you know, it's easy enough to do, but since it's a foreign thing, therefore it would come off of that, because the point is the guy doesn't actually make that much. You're saying, okay, he sells all these pumpkins, he'll get 1,000 euros off of it. Right, and that, you know, and then you take 16.5% of that, but actually he has to pay more, so he doesn't actually get 1,000. So what you have to tax is actually what he'll get.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So you have to remove all the things like that. So that's always what has to be considered. Then there's certain things that you make more profit off of, certain things you make less profit off of, so therefore the tax difference. Just so. Therefore, Manu gives what areas it taxes. Some taxes are as low as like 2%. And other taxes may be more, because the nature of what it is, then you get more or less profit from that. Does that make sense? You know, so it just depends upon the commodity itself. Because certain things people won't pay, well, the margin is so small, so the tax has to be small. And certain things the margin is bigger, so the tax is bigger. So the government actually has to be very up to date on what exactly is the market value of everything. Then they can tax.
Okay, then I missed something, but if the majority just live on their income, labor, they are not taxed?
Why should they be taxed if they don't make the profit?
I'm just clarifying
the tax is from the business.
The tax is
means nowadays with the salary that people get, they would actually, if you didn't tax the people, you only tax the business.
Yeah.
The people would get less salary.
Of course.
Because they don't have to pay that tax.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
But it would be cheaper to manage all of
it. It would be so much cheaper, yeah. Because instead of taxing millions and millions of people, yeah, and following up, you only have to tax hundreds of thousands. Plus, it's so much easier to, you know, go into the business place and just, you know, mm-hmm, deal with them, while you can't go door to door to everybody. You know, the business, you know, they're there, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. You can walk in and deal with people. While the people at home, you never know when they're going to be there. Yeah. So just it reduces the whole thing. So. Therefore, in other words, overall, the society becomes more prosperous.
Then what was the reason to shift to this system? What exists now that everyone is taxed?
There's just this idea that somehow or another they'll get more.
Okay.
Because maybe it is that the common person is less expert at avoiding taxes. Well, the business guys are more expert. But they're more expert because they don't want to pay the government. So if the government's protecting the people and creating that atmosphere, then the vices don't mind paying it because it's not going to be more than it should be. As we said, is this not going to be more? Then it doesn't matter, you're making €1 billion, it's still, if it's 16.5%, it's only 16.5%. It won't go up. It's not that the more you make, the higher the taxes. Because then we also have then in the corporate world that the bigger you are, the less taxes you pay. So these big corporations sometimes pay hardly any tax. Yeah. But the point is if everybody paid the proper amount of tax, then that little bit more of increase in the corporate level then will make up for so many small businesses in that who are therefore paying less. Instead of the small business paying 40%, you know, and the big corporation paying only 6%. You know, the big corporation pays that little bit more, then you can drop the little guys down, and therefore then you'll have it work nicely. But then the disadvantage is, then there's competition. So if you can have influence on the government, then you want monopolies that not look like a monopoly, therefore you get rid of anything that's not, that can be a challenge. So therefore, by having the small things have higher taxes, you get rid of them, and then the big businesses can go over.
Then there could be another reason. Let's say the way of cheating. As the business owner, I pay higher salaries, but they pay me back part of the share because that money is not taxed.
That's then what the government has to see that's not going on. Therefore, there's officers to see that that's not happening, and the government has people who see that the officers are not cheating. Like that. So that's the whole thing. So they'll watch the officers because, you know, I think it's there's a term for that they have facility above their actual pay. There's a technical term where you have a government official. He only makes, you know, $1,000, you know, let's say a month, but he's living in this multi-million dollar house, driving these fancy cars. So there's something going wrong here.
Embezzlement?
Well, that's what they're doing, but there's a term for where they're basically living above their means. Mm-hmm. It's something that they generally apply to either business persons or government officials. In other words, people who are involved with money that don't make as much money as they're spending. But it, you know, that principle. So there's people who keep an eye on all that and see all that. When they see these things, then it's investigated and they check. And otherwise, government can come in and do spot checks. It's like weights and measures. Mm-hmm. That government comes and checks them on a regular basis. You know, and it's, you don't know when they'll come. So therefore, if you should keep the proper weights. Because otherwise, if they come and find you're cheating, then you'll be punished for that.
But if the government and the citizens both are working for the sense of enjoyment, then that's never-ending story.
Yes, but that's why then we said, until you add the spiritual, you can't uplift society. So there's no question of having a purely materialistic society without the spiritual element, and it will prosper. It can't. You know, the Renaissance was there, but then everybody was generally very religious. And most of these things that are known, the arts and this, were in connection with the religious aspect. You know what I'm saying? So whenever that's there, things prosper. Of course, we know that Renaissance happens because Lord Chaitanya was present, so that's why, you know, then all these things came up. Because before that, there was nothing happening, and after that, it kind of went down also. Yeah. Anything else?
Maharaj, is the all these taxation everything is in Manu Samhita?
Yes.
Okay. So should one, can one like study this, or is there some kind of regulations for that that should not study under the...
No, it means, but study is something that, are you going to use it? If you're going to use it, then why not? The point is it's there. So there's a section when it's dealing with the kings. Then there's a whole section on explaining how taxation works. Also interest rates, they talk about interest rates. Like most of the things, it's a straight rate. You can't have all this compounding, multiple, all these different things, all the names are given. You can't use those. In other words, and they're, you know, so they're there originally as there. It means those systems are known, they just don't use them. You know, does that make sense? So much of the modern methods of doing these things wouldn't be used. We say, well, how do you make money? It's that, no, you're making it on the stable and steady things. That things, things cost a certain amount, they're sold at a certain amount. So because of that, then, therefore, everybody makes profit, everybody gets their needs. But the idea is the common person should be able to get their needs fulfilled, and at the same time, the person endeavoring to supply that should make his profit. And naturally, the businessman, one who's putting in that extra effort, he'll have more facilities than the common person. So this idea that everybody must have the same and that no one can be rich, no one can be poor. No, people who are going to work, they get more. So the businessman gets more because he does, but he shouldn't get more than he should. He shouldn't get less than he shouldn't get more than he should. You know, and the common person has to pay something, you know, because they're getting it from their work, but it shouldn't be more than required. You know, in other words, the necessities of life should be easy to get. And then if you want something rare and like that, that'll cost you more. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Let me just wanted to ask about, just to clarify, is it that Machiavellian approach, is it just part, a small part of Artha Shastra?
It's that Niti Shastra.
Niti Shastra.
So Niti is a small part of Artha, which is a part of Dharma. So in other words, Dharma is the bigger picture. So in other words, you could say is, Dharma is the more, is the high, it means if you want to put it in the context of the org management, then you would say Dharma is the strategy. Artha is the operational, Niti is the tactical. So it's the smaller present. Dealing with something right now, practically dealing with that, that's Niti. You know, the bigger picture of that, then that will be Artha. And then why you're doing that, what are the rules behind that? Are, you know, what is your duty and what's not your duty? That will be the Dharma. And then, of course, Sanatana Dharma then means then you're seeing you as the soul, how you're engaging that in the Lord's service. So you're engaged in that because... so you can engage in devotional service. So all these things are there. So a practical manager should know all these levels. And you're doing, what's the results? What's that results used for? One, it's used for Krishna, but what's the practical results on how people engage it in their life? So you have to know how sense gratification works, how artha and niti work, how Dharma works, how Moksha works, and how Bhakti works. Then you can lead society, because society functions on all these five. But there's a hierarchy. In other words, Bhakti is the highest, spiritual is then the next down, then Dharma is down from that, then Artha, and then Kama. So you always have to know as Kama is the lowest. So it always, the motive for things has to be the Bhakti. So it has to be seen from that way. But the senses are taken care of, therefore facilities come, and it means you follow these higher three, you will get the lower two. Okay? In other words, you follow Dharma, the spirituality, and Bhakti, you will get Artha and Kama. Okay? Something else? Yes?
How do demigods communicate with each other?
How do they communicate?
Yeah.
Generally, they
have one planet.
They go and visit each other. They talk, they think. No, no. Telepathy, that was the 50s thing. It's out now, you know. Like that. And the only guys that, you know, that seem to be it works like that nicely are those funny brains sitting in some kind of liquid in some kind of funny box on the planet of Dune. So yeah. It doesn't seem to be a universal principle. So demigods, they just talk to each other. That's why these conversations that are in Bhagavatam, the Vedic literature, those are conversations between demigods.
And demons, do tailors telepathy?
No, they talk also.
Okay. Yeah. But they have the ability to do so if they want to.
Which?
The demons. Or
telepathy. No, no one uses telepathy. Okay. It's just it's something made up by people who made up, you know, Twilight Zone, you know, something like that. You know, it was popular in the 50s, but then they figured out that everything, all the inorganic development that human beings make that was supposed to be perfection of society just basically kills people, so then they went back to the natural and organic. So it was just a thought that would be great, but it didn't work out. So there is no telepathy.
We have a Facebook, we're superior on Facebook.
And then Facebook.
They have to go visit each other to talk. We have Facebook, we don't have to go anywhere.
Right? But do you not have to go in front of your computer?
Sit there all the time, mother. I'm old.
Okay, so as long as you have this nice table set up in the toilet with a refrigerator next to it, then you're okay. Yeah, just make sure you don't move the screen that anybody can actually see you in the toilet. You know, keep it up. You know.
In the soup.
Yeah.
Keep it professional.
Yeah, keep it professional. Yeah, and know when to hit the mute button. Yeah, so, yes. These things are nice. That's what sci-fi is about, is that it comes up with these things. Nerds like it because it uses the brain. Oh, this could happen, that can happen. And so it's intellectually interesting, but in reality, not. You know, like the dark elves that bring in darkness and that overtakes the light. And no, dark is there only because light goes away. As soon as light comes back, the dark goes away. So there's no question that dark can overtake light. Dark is just no light. You know, so it's not that dark's on its own, it's its own entity. No, it's just it's just like being poor means you don't have money. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing, is that there are certain concepts they go with. You know, the guy comes back from the future and impregnates the girl who actually then ends up as his mother in the future that he's it's, you know, and then that's just more straightforward. Then they make it more weird than that. You know, they get then this one, this and that. And there's nothing better to do. You know, does that make sense? Because it sounds interesting. You know, it doesn't sound normal. You know, so it catches your attention. You know, back to the future. You know, it's just whoa. You know, so what does that mean? Yes.
And the pastor said that there are like demons who are in control of the planet, and they are also powerful in doing all kinds of tantric rites, black magic, and they are influencing actually people by demonic forces. So this is there. It's not telepathy, but there are still dark forces.
There's dark forces, but they're working according to the particular laws of nature that govern dark forces. You can't just make something up yourself. You know what I'm saying? You know, you can't be sitting there doing a black magic ritual where you're, how you say, sacrificing your banana pancake or something. You know, there's rules. You know what I'm saying? And you follow those and it has influence. But it's not that there's these ones bigger than what you're seeing and influencing the whole thing. Well, where's the karma to do all that? Right? You know, it says that the demons take birth and all that to do. It's even in animal society. You know, they'll be take birth, and let's say amongst elephants, and they'll be the biggest elephants, so they're in charge of the herd. They just want to be in control. So even if they're an elephant and they got their herd, but then there's another demon with their herd, and then they fight. So it's not that there's these few guys that are sitting there cooperating and controlling the whole planet and all that. And, you know, in the background, you hear the music, you know, like that, and then you see, you know, like that. It's not happening. like that. They're controlled by the modes of nature, so they can only do what the modes of nature allow. You know, this idea, the conspiracy that's here and this, and, you know, it's not like that. It's just as you can overeat, oversleep, you know, overindulge in sex, you can overindulge in fear. So conspiracy theories are overindulgence in fear. So you can know it's so real that people think eating so much food or having so much sex is real also. You know what I'm saying? But that's all it is, overindulgence in fear, right? There should be a natural amount of fear, not that much. You know, everything, you know, my watch is watching me. You know what I'm saying? The thing is, but then if your computer is watching you because it has the little thing on it that it can watch, you know, it means it has the camera for Facebook and all those things like that, right? And so therefore that's where everybody, if they want to cover it, they're going to put the tape there. But what if that's not where that camera is? What if it's the screen itself? What if it's something else? You know, what if it's your, you know, shift bar? You know what I'm saying? You know, another, which letter do you hit the least? You know, Z or something else, you know, maybe that's it. You know, they light up. How do you know it's not watching you? You know? You know what I'm saying? It's just, we have all these ideas that, oh, it has to be this, but, you know, why would it have to be like that? You know, it's not that people aren't trying to do all these funny things, but that's a group of individuals who have their own certain thing, and they may have more or less control, but then there's always someone else who has other control, and it's a competition. So it's never that there's one group who controls everything. They would love to, but they can't. Does that make sense? So the Illuminati still have no control over those demons who took birth as elephants in Africa and are running their own herd. So they're not going to control everything.